Hi and welcome to Matrix Moments. This is Saloni, and on today's episode, we dive deep into PhonePe's journey. Vikram Vaidyanathan, Managing Director at Matrix Partners India, has an unfiltered conversation with Sameer Nigam, Co-founder and CEO at PhonePe. They talk about what it takes to build one of India's leading digital payments platform, from Sameer's early days at Flipkart to starting and building PhonePe and then selling to Flipkart. They cover all of this and more. Tune in.
Guys, thanks everyone for joining us for this pretty special podcast. Huge welcome to Sameer Nigam, who needs no introduction. And Sameer, thank you for doing this for us, but I'm going to introduce you anyway. And I was going back and looking at your LinkedIn, which I haven't done in a long time, but I went and looked at your LinkedIn and it said Flipkart, PhonePe, Wharton, right? But it is actually amazing that those are the big chunks of your life, and you've actually been at this for a while. Mumbai born and bred, ended up at Wharton, started a bunch of companies and that's probably less known as a serial entrepreneur. Sold a company to Flipkart, and that's how you ended up at Flipkart. And then it's just been a fantastic journey, both at Flipkart, then starting PhonePe, and then being still part of the Flipkart mothership, but doing your own thing. It's just been a fantastic journey to watch. And thank you for joining us on this.
Thanks, Vikram. Always a pleasure.
So, Sameer, I'm going to take you back to the old days and circa, 12, 13, 14, on the Flipkart floor, as you guys used to call it. And, all the people who ran that floor, right? You, Chari, Mukesh, and Ankit, the Udaan guys, there is so much talent there, which then led to huge companies. So talk a little bit about that floor. What made it special? What were your learnings from there?
Yeah, I think it's one of the most exciting parts of my career till date. I think anyone who was there in those days, they were equal parts heady, equal parts just stressful, just because I think Flipkart was really a bunch of very, very sharp young people who came together, and then over the years added some incredible sort of seasoned talent, as I may. And I think the one thing that really stood out for me with that company and started with Sachin and Vinny was just open-ended ambition. We were working in a small startup, Rahul and myself, my co-founder, in Bombay at the time. We were working in the music industry and learned the very hard way you don't make money in the music industry easily. But we met up with Vinny and Amod and Mekin, part of the very early team. And we met for half a day. We shook hands. We kind of moved in and then completed the deal paperwork ages later. Because what we were just really excited by was a bunch of folks that were saying customer and technology first, everything else will follow. They literally didn't have a business plan. I think most of the leadership team honestly didn't even know what a P&L looked like at that point, but they had very, very bold missions. Around that time, in fact, I'll give you two quick anecdotes to give you a sense for why people thought big at that place. When we met Vinny the first time, there was a rumor that Amazon might be buying Flipkart for $700 million. So when we asked him about whether they're likely to sell, his response was, "I'm in my mid-20s. By the time I'm done, people should be asking us if we're buying Amazon. That's the way I want to think about this," right? We're like, that's just amazingly bold and amazingly sort of crazy at the same time. Then we met Sachin. And again, this is 2011, 10, 11. And he spent half an hour on a whiteboard walking Burzin, Rahul, and myself, the three co-founders, through his argument for why e-commerce will be a $25 to $30 billion business by 2020. This is 2011. People are still not over the hump of actually paying online, and why Flipkart could be a $20 billion company by then. And again, I remember leaving that meeting, and Burzin, who's almost a decade older than the two of us, looked at us and said, "Either these guys are just batshit crazy, or they're just going to change the world, and I think we should join," right? I mean, I think that outlook on life, taking a 20, 30, 40-year view when you're in your mid-20s, I haven't seen that often in entrepreneurs. Just really hard to imagine what life will be like when you're twice your age. And being able to say within that we will conquer the world no matter what. And that was true with Sujit and Amod and Mick and a lot of the guys we joined in 2011. And I think it became very, very indoctrinated in the culture of that place. Obviously, success helps. But even in the down cycles that every company goes through them, I think the perseverance was there. And I think you see that now with all of the entrepreneurs that have come out of that place, not just entrepreneurs, CEOs. There's hardly anyone I know who comes out of that company, even today, with Anand's startup and Nishant Verman and Vikas Bansal and that entire leadership roster today, who comes out and says, I want to work for someone, I want to do something incremental. Everyone comes out and says, let me identify a really large opportunity and try and sort of change the market. I think that is really, really sort of been, and I think it shaped a lot of our decisioning at PhonePe in the early days.
So the one thing that struck me about that time was all of you guys played so many roles. I think you played, I don't know, 5-6 roles, growth, engineering, product. And when I go through most people's trajectory within Flipkart at that time, everybody played so many roles. What made that work and how did it shape each of you guys?
So I think the shaping is easier, right? I think just that exposure at that scale, when you're growing 10x a year over a 4-5 year window, I think that exposure helped all of our careers. There's no question about it. I think everyone becomes a much more seasoned entrepreneur when you come out. Because as an entrepreneur, you're basically out there, you're on every function, right? You're a lawyer and a marketeer and a copywriter and you're a coder. So it helped a lot of us. I think why it worked well was if you see that team, one level below Sachin and Vinny, a lot of folks had a very, very strong either tech background or business background or both. And I think we had the right combination of mix of those. So either people were just so young that they didn't know better and they said, well, we're just going to make it happen. And that's just the entire founding team there at that company was all IIT. And so they were just very, very analytically sharp, whether they were in the tech functions like Anamod or whether they were people like Sujit. Or there were people on the business side, again, who didn't know what failing looks like because they were just too young. So I think we felt comfortable saying this is the biggest set of problems to be solved over the next 12 or 18 months. And the founders, I think, put trust in the leadership team saying we'll put the smartest people available at this point of time on those problems. We figured it out as we went.
You know, one of the things that always strikes me when I talk to you is that, you know, you're playing the orchestra, right? And I think you've been phenomenal at both choosing the orchestra and then sort of making it hum. And so I'm going to start on that thread, which is you, Chari Burzin, and it's sort of, you've been joined at the hip since, I don't know, forever. I guess it was an obvious choice for you in some ways to say, hey, I'm leaving Flipkart and I'm going to start up again and it's going to be the three of us again. So one, you know, was that an automatic choice because you had so many others from Flipkart you could join? Why was that an automatic choice and what makes it work for the three of you?
So I think the two of them was an automatic choice.
Pause there, but and talk a little bit about you, Burzin, Chari, and you know, when you guys met and how did you guys start?
Yeah, no, I was just saying that I think given how long we've known each other, Chari and I went to undergrad in Bombay. So we've known each other since, 1995. So it's 26 years now. His wife was a junior of ours in college. So I mean, literally the families have known each other. We were roommates in Arizona. And so I think that one was just very, very easy, right? I think we know each other for so long that we know that value system thinking, like thought process, strategic thought process, and trust, you can just take for granted. Just absolutely, like in my eyes, with my eyes closed, if there's anything that we need to sort of take a call on these aspects, how do we treat employees? How do we treat partners? What kind of company are we going to build? And whether it's going to be technology led or not. I think having the luxury of having three founders where anyone can answer that on behalf of the others, literally, we complete our sentences is huge. Burzin and I met when I just started out my career in Los Angeles. So that was again 2000, 2001. So it's been 20 years, right? So we've gone through a lot In our first venture, when we started out, we were all first-time entrepreneurs. We again decided to build an iTunes-like platform for India. We knew nothing about the Indian market. We were all three in the States. We knew nothing about the music industry, but we were having a ton of fun building. And I think we enjoyed working with each other so much that starting up again was a no-brainer. I think where 10 years of the entrepreneurial journey, and especially the Flipkart stint, helped us was identifying much larger markets. One learning with the music industry was the size of the pie is big enough, the proverbial size of the pie is big enough, you can meander around and strike gold. Second was, we're much better at building large-scale platforms than we enjoyed a lot more as technologists. Building large-scale, massy, high social impact platforms than building great experiences. If I was building an iTunes-like player again, I would have gone to a Mukesh Bansal. I think he's the best branding like I've met in the country in this space. And just look at what he's done with Cult. I mean, he's made sweating feel cool, right? If we were trying to actually build a very, very large supply chain kind of a company, I would have gone to people like Sujit and Vaibhav Gupta and others at Oran, and look at what they're doing there. When we decided that we're moving on from Flip and we're going to start over, we were very clear that we want to build something which has technology, not as the enabling function, but as the reason for existence, right? So Burzin and Rahul, I think, were automatic calls. I did talk to Amol. I think he's one of the most fertile thinkers I've met in my life in the technology sphere again. But again, I think he did decided to pursue the venture with Oran, or the venture with Sujit and VG that eventually became Oran. But those were the only three people I could think of. I think a lot of others were in that team at Flipkart. We'd also gone through this combustion engine, right? We knew so much about each other. We'd gone through adversity, we'd gone through upside. We knew where the DNA match was the highest and the comfort level was the highest. But I felt that for what we wanted to do next, I wanted pure play technologists at the helm. So that was the founding team.
Sorry, Samir, I'm going to pause you there and just sort of highlight a few things for our listeners. So first, you know, we always say that the best co-founders are found in shared history. And for you guys, that's just like so true. But the two things that you talked about, which is values and trust, and they're a bit interrelated. And often young founders don't think about it enough, right? Is my value system the same? And would I trust this person to behave the same way and make the same decisions, even if they are far away? And for people who don't know, Burzin is in the US most of the time, and you guys just have this implicit trust between you guys, and that's a fantastic thing. And the second thing, which is tech as the reason for existence. And now when you say it, I remember our conversation, and you really wanted to get back to those tech roots and then chose people who had that as their core, which is the tech as the reason for existence. Thinking very sharply about this is the DNA that I common DNA that I wanted every single person at the beginning is another thing that founders underestimate. And I just want to talk about the rest of the team, because you preserved that DNA, and maybe not tech as the core, but there is, you know, when you meet a PhonePe person, you know it's a PhonePe person, and you've got pretty low churn. There's a reason that people stick and love working at PhonePe. What is that?
I do believe actually it does go back at the core to value, tech, and trust. Allow me a minute to actually sort of delve into that further. When I said values and trust separately, there's a reason for it. I think too many founders, young folks, confuse bonding with trust. When you're building an organization, we keep saying this at PhonePe and DownAlls, trust means nothing, transparency is everything. And again, I think something that we've imbibed very early on, it's still my CFO's nightmare, but since the first month, when we launched, we told all employees, we will always, 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 unless the Securities Exchange prevents us, show the entire MIS and P&L of the company to all employees simultaneously. We do it every month, we're 5 years in. So everyone at PhonePe who's working there sees the EBITDA, sees the FCF. We have designers come and ask us things like, How does the monetization work? It's amazing. It's amazing when that doesn't get leaked. At least till now, it hasn't, right? And it's a long-standing trust model with the finance team and the legal team saying, until that trust is betrayed, we will always persevere. Now, there will come a time when somebody might actually betray that trust. But I genuinely believe if you operate in a model where the transparency is super high, most human beings, most of the time, will never betray that trust. And I think that's what I meant by our trust model. That's at the corporate level, really, in terms of the culture we wanted to build. If you aren't learning, then you're just working for us. And if you're an employee, you'll just find the best employee. We want to make it a lot more participative. We want to make sure that 10 years later, when people talk about us, like we were at Flipkart, people say, if you were at PhonePe, you've got such tremendous grounding that you can do anything because you learned a lot, right? We were lucky at Flip. Binny and Sachin started that, and we all sort of followed through on that promise of providing tremendous learning. You hear of companies like Levers and others, just institutionalize this, right? So I think the flavor of trust is important. Values is at a personal level. Values are about, will you preserve short-term cash, or will you actually retain all your employees during COVID? Will you pay their salaries and their bonuses? And will you do all the right things? And will you try and provide oxygen? So you asked me that, and now answering your question on why people still stay. I think it's a model of reciprocity and mutual respect. And God knows I have a temper, you know that. We fight and we argue like cats and dogs on product, but it's never personal. And I think that's important. That distinction between this is the right thing for the consumer or this is the wrong thing for the consumer versus you are an idiot or not. I think it's very important that entrepreneurs understand you'll set not just the product vision, you'll set the culture in the first year or two. And so if you have people that are just listening to you and they're hierarchical, the culture is dead because no one's going to speak up. But if you have a model where you're just polite to people and you're not willing to challenge ideas, you are also dead because then the business won't grow. And I think striking that balance, I like to believe the first 50 to 100 people we got, well, a lot of them in the leadership roles today, share that. That's how we handpicked talent. That's how we identified who belongs and doesn't. It wasn't on pure tech jobs or business jobs. It was, do you have the temerity to say, no, I disagree regardless of rank or file? Do you have a fertile enough brain where those ideas matter? I don't want to hear really dumb ideas all the time just to be democratic about it. I want really smart people, but I want people to be fearless.
No, and you know, when you articulate this thing about transparency, actually full disclaimer, my wife works for Sameer. So, and I'm definitely married up, and you keep reminding me that. So, and I was asking her, I said, I'm going to do this podcast with Sameer. What is common to Sameer, Rahul and Burjin? And her fat answer was, they're very direct and they're very transparent. And you will always know where they stand, right? And what you see is what you get. And I think your team is actually pretty mature, and you didn't hire like, you did hire freshers later, but in the beginning, you hired pretty mature individuals, and they all appreciated the what you see is what you get. And you know, the fact that it was respectful disagreements about issues versus disagreements about people. And I think that's been fantastic to see. I want to switch gears on UPI and take you back to those times when, you know, between NPC, iSpirit, there used to be these UPI sandbox conferences where people were tinkering around trying to build something on the back of UPI, and it was like 15, 20 people who had been dragged into a room saying, why don't you think about UPI? And you were there at Ground Zero, right? Yeah. And actually we reconnected around some of that. What made you believe at that point in time? And you had like sheer belief, man, that this would be the thing that's going to change everything. So what made you believe that?
So when there's a massive, as they say, a delta force change coming, right? If I look at lead indicators in a space that's heavily regulated, by the way, very important to see who's driving the change. On that particular one, we were looking at working with a bunch of the big banks on IMPS, building that brokering layer that eventually actually UPI itself is. And we realized that we don't have a prayer, because like any other market in the world, the Indian banking system is so strong that self-disruption for the larger good won't happen. So IMPS was looking tough. The rails were there, but you'd have to do a lot of work to convince partners. When UPI was the first hackathon that we heard, I think you were also there. We heard Mr. Nilekani, we heard Pramod Verma, we heard Sanjay Jain and Sharad Sharma. But by the way, I think what tipped it for us in that first meeting itself was the fact that the regulator was very, very excited. NPCI was very, very excited about the chances. And we saw at least two or three big banks having said, we are in already. Axis and ICICI, if I remember correctly. So you had a few big banks willing to take the bet. And then the RBI sort of soundbite started coming, Mr. Rajan. And he said, we're going to change the way payments happens. And then we started hearing the government is getting excited about this. I think by the time we were two or three months in, two things were certain. There's going to be a legit shot at this happening. Now, everyone we spoke to, and I remember you also talking to people, when all the banks was telling us this will never happen, and everyone around them that actually can influence strategy and policy was saying this is happening, for me, that's a punt worth taking. Because what it's almost like crypto, for example. I would not enter, and I still won't enter the crypto market if it is not central bank bank. But if the Reserve Bank said, we are going to launch a central bank bank, crypto, and everyone said nobody would adopt crypto, like you're nuts. I'd start PhonePe 2.0 tomorrow right now, right? So I think the enabling factors were there. The second thing, and the reason I think we fancied our chances, was just plainly put stage of life. Rahul and myself were knocking on 40, Burzum was knocking on 50. We tasted some success in our previous ventures. We had the luxury of taking that 1% fund for a very, very large outside opportunity. Like we could afford to. Yeah. We could afford to fail. We knew what it looked like.
But it was going for broke in some sense.
Yeah, absolutely going for broke, right? I mean, you're doing it on a promise. And if you remember when UPI launched, SBI, HDFC, Bank of Baroda, Kota, everyone was still poo-pooing it, saying, yeah, not really happening. Demon carried it. The Prime Minister carried it. The Bheem app naming carried it. So you go for broke. When you can afford to, yeah, you should go for broke.
So the one other thing, and we'll come back to Demon, is at that point of time, you were imagining the future in a way that others weren't, right? I remember one seminal whiteboarding session where you're talking about money transfers as easy as messaging, right? And it needs to be integrated with messaging. And now it's a reality. Everybody, that's how you do it. You send money, text right there, and it is fully integrated. What I'm trying to decipher for early founders, how do you get that kind of consumer insight? Were you sort of immersing yourself in what consumers were doing? What was that aha moment?
So there were two paths to how we arrived there. One was experience. The second was insight, right? The experience we'd had at Flipkart with things like the Big Billion Day, where the payment rails were just falling apart, with the fact that while e-commerce had taken off, 70% of people were still choosing cash on delivery because two-factor authentication with OTP and God knows what else was just such a nightmare. And I think the last thing that Lisa was, you remember Jan Dhan Man was going on that time, 120 million accounts getting added a year, but nobody was using net banking. It just told you that disruption is a must. What's happening today can't take us to sort of, the future will have to look different if payments will take off. So it's a problem to be solved at scale. In terms of the opportunity, it was actually much simpler. When I look at the just technology trends and consumer behavior for the last 25 years, ever since the internet came along, 10, 15, 20 players in any market at any time have gotten together and said, this sector is never going to look the same 5 years later. It's happened in ticketing, which was an obvious. It happened in, because you never want to go and stand in a line. What's the upside of standing in a long line at a railway station or an airport? Changed completely. Concerts, movie theaters, shopping. Shopping was more complex. That's why e-commerce adoption is still sub 20% in most markets. But in any sector where the goods or services being exchanged between two parties are not in question, and money is the easiest. I give you money, you give me money. Money is money. The flavor of money is not changing. That transaction technology has to completely irreversibly just simplify. And for us in India, given the mobile phone penetration, given the data penetration, and given how small the commerce, e-commerce base was, 100, 150 million people 5 years ago, remember. Everyone was investing in startups saying the market will open up. Jio and Airtel said the data's opened up. And there was this vacuum in between. And we just felt that if a brokering layer is connecting 100 banks without me putting in that effort, as long as I can build a mind-blowing interface and keep it really simple, I have an opportunity to run the population and say, a billion people can pay, make payments using an app. So that opportunity is very, very rare, but it was very clear consumers would want it if you can deliver it. So I think that's the way to think about it.
So going back to Demon and now COVID and, the best events in most people's lives, but they were big, big events for India payments. So let's say some of these things didn't happen. Would we be still here where consumer payments is ubiquitous and it's a full-blown pull product? We had to push people to use digital payments not very long ago.
I think without Demon, the urgency for people to find an alternative to cash for money transfer and salary remittances would not have happened. And without that, the forcing function for the government and particularly the Prime Minister and Niti Aayog and a lot of people putting their name and face behind Beam UPI is safe. The trust would not have come that early. That there's no amount of money that can buy that kind of trust building by the government and that kind of a forcing function. So I believe without Demon, digital payments in India would have looked very, very different. Probably UPI may never become a complete story. There was just so much tug and pull that the banks may have prevailed in slowing things down. I think COVID is a different story. I actually do believe COVID is not the accelerant that people believe it is. I think COVID's made digital payments permanent. It has not opened up the market further. And my reason for saying that is we are looking at the offline market, right? That's the best measure of whether COVID had an impact because now you're at home. The offline transactions were just absolutely exploding, Vikram. And 80% of transactions were already tier two and beyond. So it was already very clear that digital payments will grow from here. In fact, COVID limited the ability of a lot of us to advertise on Vasi platforms like IPL. COVID limited the number of use cases you could offer. So I think it's made it, it's limited the consumer adoption. It has strengthened the per capita transaction volume. Those who are using are never going back, but those who should be using, I think we're moving slower than we could.
I actually think it's a bit of both, and you obviously have the data to back what you're saying, but for sure, it has just come up in your wallet, right? In terms of your own transaction stack, it's just essentially the number one option to pay for anything, which wasn't the case. But I also think a lot of people who are using it one-off for one transaction suddenly are using it, like this has become on the first screen of your phone. Moving on to one big decision that you made very early, lots of investors were chasing you, me included, and hopefully ahead of the pack. You chose to sell to Flipkart. You had all the money at your doorstep, but you chose to go back to Flipkart. What sort of drove that decision?
Yeah, it was one of the hardest ones in life. It came down to the following. I think we had an incredible set of investors, knock on wood, leading, and you guys were leading there. You guys were willing to put faith behind us or in us. There was Norvis, I remember. There's a few others. I think it came down to the following. It came down again to just core motivation. On day zero, when we started out, Rahul had said, I am just so tired from the Flipkart journey, as exhilarating as it was. I want to build a really, really small team and do something like WhatsApp. They just announced their exit thing. 20, 30 people, no more than 100 in the company. That was his sort of holy cow. But he was as excited, if not more excited, by financial inclusion and financial services, even beyond payments at the time. So when we looked at what he wanted to do and what I wanted to do, I wanted to build an app store and I wanted to build a bunch of other stuff. Even then, you'd remember that. You guys are like, these guys are nuts. I wanted to build a mobile browser. I wanted to build a bunch of stuff. Payments was the common leg. Now, once we agreed on payments, and this is while we were talking to all of you, there was Paytm and FreeCharge and all these other guys, and they were raising bucket loads of money, particularly, I think, Paytm at the time. And I think what became very apparent to us was we're taking there's a 1% probability that UPI succeeds. So the odds already stacked up against us. But if that 1% happens, if we aren't first to market and we can't really blitz from there with a deep capital war chest, it won't work. Now, the investors we had would have backed us on the capital, but the threats needed to be out of the way, at least a bunch of them. Flipkart, on the other hand, was a very, very interesting proposition. Vinny had come again as CEO. We knew each other well enough over all these years where I think he knew and the board knew that we would go for growth and we would go for scale. We were transparent about the fact that we're going for broke, but they knew that we'd go for scale right after. We wouldn't hold back. So that alignment was there. And when Vinny told us, we'll let you run completely independently and the culture is different, I think that was it. Right? That was sacred to us. I think we passed the age in life where we're willing to inherit culture and not build it our way.
I always think it was a very special situation, because if it wasn't you and Chari and Borzin who were actually Flipkart insiders and loved Flipkart, yeah, I don't think anyone else would have done that decision. And second, I think it was a pretty big deal. If it wasn't actually the people that were there on the other side who knew you guys would take such a big bet, it wouldn't have happened. So I think it was just one of those things that magically came together, and it's just a special situation. So I don't know if there's that much to learn for other founders from it, but I do think there's a big learning for founders from it in how you structured it to make sure that you stay independent, run it independently, or independent capital, or culture was independent. So talk a little bit about that for founders who are maybe thinking about potentially selling, but are worried about whether they will pursue their dream or whether they will be allowed to pursue their dream in an independent fashion.
So today at our scale, we also talk to a lot of founders, right, about potential acquihires, acquisitions, etc. I think two learnings that I had during that whole episode. One, I think founders really need to understand whether they're trying to merge with a larger sort of company because they want an exit or because they want a space where they can incubate what they were working on. Is it safe harbor or is it an end state? If it's an end state, don't fool yourself. The party that's buying you is clear about why they're buying you. It's either for talent or for some IP, but they have a point of view. In our case, because UPI didn't even exist, and because Flipkart didn't have a payments arm as such, it was easy. Vinny was looking at what's happening in payments, said, I think this group deserves to have a play in payments. It's going to be huge. I would like for you guys to incubate it independently. So it's easy. So first, you need to be very transparent about what you're looking for as the seller before the buyer can actually sort of make a point of view. Don't fool yourself. I did that in my first venture with Vinny, I remember. We had this really cool platform that was powering Ghana and a bunch of startups. It made no money. We were just married to the IP. We were just having fun. And Vinny told us, I will not stop you. You decide 1 month after we launch Flight if you still want to be doing this. And in a month, we'd done more downloads on the B2C side than we'd done in 3 years on the other side. And we're like, yeah, why are we wasting our time? Right? It's a hard learning. It's very hard to give up on your dream and merge it with another. So I think that's one clear learning. I think the second one, if you want to incubate what you're doing, model it like a startup, then don't demand parity on salary and having all the perks of a large 10, 15, $20 million company. Be scrappy. Again, you'd remember this. We continued working in this really, really dingy office outside of HSR. We didn't have car parking. People would come in and deflate the tires. The village there. We structured the cash commitment over a 3-year committed model based on targets. So our upside was linked to delivery. All the risk was ours. The upside was higher than the average person at Flipkart if we delivered. So we managed to structure it in line with how their board, us, Vinny, everyone wanted to actually operate this. That I think is easier said than done in most cases. We knew people there. So you're right. I think we got to cheat a bit. Everyone knew each other.
That's just a fantastic story. And you should tell it a lot more.
I'm going to move gears to payments and payments evolution. And this is going to end in a fight. But I'm going to go there anyway. So start with this, which is, do you think we've essentially driven payments penetration at the expense of the business model? And I'm just saying we collectively, all of us. And is that sustainable?
I think I know where you're going with that. To me, I think there are serious question marks on the UPI model. If that's where you're going. I've said this before, so I don't think I can pretend that I haven't. I think the zero MDR policy is a bad idea. I think it's a bad idea for two reasons. One, any industry at its nascency, trying to drive a change in consumer behavior requires a lot of investment. This has been true even in the offline world for decades. You used to have coupons and cashbacks and discounts in the physical stores. I mean, you're talking about the digital world now. It takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of marketing. It takes a lot of building trust and fraud systems and tremendous IP. And God knows engineers are super expensive today. You know this better than most. So to not have a clear revenue model and an incentive for entrepreneurs means you're forcing people to make unnatural choices. Early stage entrepreneurs are not entering the payments market in a way I would have loved to see. People often tell us, well, you use marketing. Well, I had the opportunity. I sold my company. I didn't have a single share in my company. That's what it costs. But that's one in a million people, right? We were just in a different stage of life. If we'd raised capital from you guys at Matrix and come and told you, I want to spend $1 billion doing it for social good, but we won't ever make money.
Yeah.
I know which door you chose. Right. And I think that's a really bad structural choice that they've made. That's one. Second, I never lose sight of the fact that we are all building the application layer and core platform leg, but money movement's happening through the banks. And I think this notion that somehow you can disrupt how payments are happening and also disrupt the business model and the investment model of the banking system below it and weaken it, I think is fool's paradise. It's like trying to tell Jio and Airtel and Vodafone and all these telcos, we want a tower at every square kilometer in India. We want you to pay for spectrum. We want everyone to have 5G. And by the way, you'll never make a penny because we gave you spectrum cheap. Yeah, that doesn't work.
And you know, this is the one maybe that gets me, which is we're probably ahead of every country in the world with our payment system. But every country in the world affords a payments company to make money on their core business model. And that allows for investments in, like you said, infrastructure, fraud, security. And right now we are trusting the payments companies with a lot of our data. And unless we provide a business model collectively as a country, I just don't think payments innovation will happen. And I think you touched upon a very important topic, which is young founders are not starting up in payments. And so they're going to drive a lot of the innovation. And unless there's a core business model, I just don't think that will happen. And I know you have a pretty loud voice, and I'm hoping some of that voice actually gets through. Switching gears, right, to this often used phase, which is, it's fine. You can't make money on payments, but you can make money on data monetization. And so what do you think about that?
See, that one's interesting. I think there is some merit to it. I think payments data is the gold standard of data, right? And I think to that end, the fact that the payments market is opening up so fast is helpful. I think that data, if harnessed well, can unlock a lot of value in the financial services that are just adjacent. Again, the problem is with how the ecosystem is shaping up. The banks are the custodians of the data as the sponsors in this model of UPI, but they don't have a relationship with the consumers that are not banking with them today. So you may have a lot of money movement, transaction movement, etc., but you're invisible to the customer. On the other side, companies like us, if we can't make money off payments directly, we have to use that data and try and figure out alternate business models around it. Now, where's the trust at? The trust is highest with the banking system. Then it goes on to the insurance, et cetera, and then to the fintechs. I mean, that's, and I think that's correct. Because the tech behemoths of the world haven't done a very good job on the privacy front. Now, on the one side, regulation is coming in, and again, correctly so, limiting the amount of data abuse that is happening in terms of the capturing of it. On the other side, you're creating perverse incentive to capture and exploit and monetize that same data. So I think that friction won't expose itself today, by the way. I think it's looming. It's going to come up in the next about 24 months, because at some point, the data privacy bill will go through. At some point, this very unique non-personal data privacy act will go through, which is saying that your and my data is public goods. And companies like us will get squeezed right in the middle. We'll get squeezed because we're sitting on a copious amount of data. We could capture a lot more and upset the customer, but open up the financial inclusion agenda. Or we could clamp down on the data, be more Apple-esque, be right, do right by customers on the data side, and then forego any ability to monetize. And therein lies the conundrum.
Yeah. Well, I think I had two things. One, I don't like the phrase data monetization, right? Because that inherently is just like a wrong term, that you're taking my data and you're monetizing it, and that's your core business model that can't exist. But if you also go back to maybe the more, the early days where everyone had rose-tinted glasses on what this could be, one of the core principles was that the data or the choice of sharing one's data would reside with the user. And I think as we sort of put people like yourself in a position where, you know, the only way to monetize is to create something from the data, the user no longer actually has a choice or no longer has control. And I think that was fundamentally core to this entire system getting designed by the initial architects, Pramod, and everyone else, and including you guys, right? And do you feel like that this is just is just taking away from that early goal where the user had full control?
No, so I think the good news is I think account aggregators finally, I think COVID delayed things, but I think account aggregator as a concept is starting to come of age. I think we will finally see regulated entities be able to use infra like Aadhaar and eKYC sooner than we imagine. I think the dust has settled at least on KYC, which is a very big enabling factor. The dust has settled on the account aggregator model. So the regulators are well within their rights to say banks must give the consumer's data to the consumer when they demand it. I think the building blocks are in place. Let's look at the last piece, which is, will businesses follow? It's all fine and dandy to say everyone can use this. Does anyone want to, right? I think that's where you're going to. I think it'll happen. I think it'll happen with or without zero MDR for a different reason. I don't think insurance penetration, stock broking, banking, lending, all of these categories, I don't think the business model for those categories was ever dependent on whether you have a payments business or not in the first place. I actually think that assuming that if you are a great payments company, you'll also be great at the others is again foolish. If data were making people very, very successful on these business models, everybody would be in 10 categories simultaneously, even in the old guard. That's not true.
Yeah.
So I think access to data through account aggregator will open up. I'm pretty bullish on that. We've applied for it. We are waiting for our final license. I think access to infrastructure like eKYC that will really make it easy and open up the funnel will open up. I think India's core public-private partnership model still works really, really well. I think the Aadhaar Supreme Court case did rattle it and challenge the way it was being designed. And I think some correction happened in the consumer's interest, by the way. I think the privacy model was required. I think the risk is actually not on that side. I think the risk is political. I think the risk is that we are also entering an environment globally where regulators and governments are trying to say, I need access to that data for governance as well, right? Their promised land is they have access to that data as well. Well, how much data will you give to a private company even with or without consent, and how much will you give to the government? I think that is the next 10-year flashpoint. I don't think a private company in a regulated space like payments or banking or any of these sectors will be able to, even with consent, innovate the way they want to, if there's a risk that the data that they're collecting can be secured by the government just freely. I think we need to find the right balance.
No, one of the things that I was that I'm always thankful for is how thoughtful some of you guys who are actually building this are, and how you're thinking at a systemic level versus just thinking about yourself. So appreciate it and thank you. Last set of questions. You've always got this ability to see the future in a way that most people don't. So if you had to start one or two companies around payments, fintech, transactional ecosystems, what would those be?
Banking for sure. I think banking will look very, very different in 10 years from here again. Again, you're seeing all of those early sort of Delta 4 changes happening, right? Regulators demanding unbundling, demanding democratization, and you're hearing the government saying penetration is not good enough, products not reaching people. And you're hearing a whole bunch of 25-year-old kids saying, I can build this better. I think there's a tsunami coming there. So I think banking is one. If I was 15 years younger, I would have entered lending today. And the reason I say that is slightly different. I think lending is not just about building great platforms. I think it's also about a lot of risk taking with, in India, no collections model. This is not the US. You don't have a credit bureau where your lights will get shut off because you didn't pay a credit card bill because you were on vacation. You get penalized bad. You can't get a house loan if you default on a car loan and so on. Here, what's the punishment? If there's no punishment to do unsecured flow-based lending, which I think that's the only part of the entire India stack story as well, where we've always had a different point of view, I think is the right answer for India. But I think the legal system needs to tighten up. If it does, and I'm willing to give it 20 years to transform, if I'm 25 again, 25-year-old me right now in a heartbeat.
Awesome. Sameer, firstly, thank you for joining us. This has just been an awesome, candid chat. Anything that you wanted to share and sort of final thoughts from you?
No, thank you. Always a pleasure chatting with you, Vikram. And I think final thoughts are, it's an absolutely amazing time to be in the tech industry in India. What excites me the most, and I'm too old to benefit from it, but I think there's the right kind of capital. There's long patient capital in India. I think founders today are able to make outsized bets and still hold on to enough equity, like in the Bay, where they'll be in the driver's seat longer. So I think we are starting to see startups which are going to actually become long sustainable companies, not just exit worthy startups. I think that for me is the big thing I'm seeing, right? It's not the unicorn every day. It's the fact that there are 50 sectors in which people are saying, I'm going to really, really transform India. And I think they have the patience to do it, which is super exciting. So good time to be here.
You know, I'm super excited about the breadth of companies that are getting created and disrupting pretty much every industry in India. So on that note, thank you for the time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Vikram. Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in. For more Matrix Moments episodes, you can head to www.matrixpartners.in/blog. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for more updates.